So we said last week we would continue today talking about right speech. And I think it's important to remember that the Eightfold Path, which includes right views, right understanding, right resolve, right views, right resolve, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, that the context for the word right in each of those is in the context of the Four Noble Truths. That it isn't like there's some, you know, ultimate judgment or ultimate arbitrator of what is right or wrong, but rather right is in relationship to the Four Noble Truths. And if you understand the Four Noble Truths, you understand how to interpret right. And I was thinking that that another way of translating the word dukkha, which is the first truth, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, usually translated as suffering, perhaps another way of translating it that makes it a little bit easier for us to understand is by translating by the word harm, the truth of harm, or the truth of harming. Because harm, at least in my brain, vocabulary, has the connotation of there's a cause to it, a very clear cause. It's usually someone's doing something to cause harm. We don't usually say, because we could say that, you know, that the tree falls on your leg and it harms you, but I think of harm more as something that people do to each other, we do to ourselves. Maybe you have a different way of using the word. So harm, so the first noble truth is the truth of harm. And then what is the cause for harm? And the cause for harm is many things, but the cause of harm is greed, hate, and delusion. And the cause of harm is our wanting things to be different, our demanding things to be different, or not wanting them to be the way they are. The cause of harm is our holding. The word holding is the one I like a lot to refer to the second noble truth. And we hold something really tight, and we demand it to be that way or demand it to be differently, that tends to cause harm. And I like the word harm, and I like this way, because what Buddhism, I think, Buddhist practice is aiming at is finding a way of living a life which is harmless, both inwardly and outwardly, to live without harming ourselves and without harming the environment, the world, our friends, the community around us. And so much of our suffering, so much of our harm that we experience, I think comes from ways in which we harm ourselves. We live a very harm-filled inner life, many of us. It could be argued that all the tension and stress that we experience in our life, it might have external conditions that kind of brings it about in a sense, but it all gets channeled through, all the external events get channeled through some way of choosing how to behave or to think or to act that then harms us by creating stress. If the neighbor is playing music late at night, it's uncomfortable, it's not pleasant not to get your sleep. But the stress that comes from that, a lot of it can come from the value judgment and the animosity and the hate and the resentment and all the kind of things, the holding patterns that the mind has. That's what actually creates the stress, not the fact that there's music there. And so the degree in which stress becomes part of our life has a lot to do with the degree in which our holding, our reactivity, our reactions filter what happens around us. And that's a whole area of choice that we have. So the internal harm, we harm ourselves, and we harm our friends and our community and around us. And one of the places to see where a lot of harm happens, especially externally, is in speech. And so that you can understand that one of the reasons why speech is included as in the Eightfold Path is because of the tremendous amount of harm that is created through speech. And I suspect that if all we did was practice right speech, if all we did was to practice speech which didn't cause harm, that our lives would be a lot smoother, a lot easier. And then if we added to that, if we only practiced harmless thinking, if thinking is a kind of speech, we'd be an easy street. So our speech, right speech. I paid a lot of attention to speech, my talking. And I've told this here many times. When I was in the monastery at Tassajara, and we had these long periods of silence, they had a funny way of counting days in the monasteries. They had funny ways of counting the weeks. They didn't have 7-day weeks, they had 5-day weeks. So we were completely out of sync from anybody else. And that was kind of the charm. You're kind of in this timeless, different kind of time. But also, they somehow counted the days differently. So anyway, the day started with zazen in the evening, with meditation, the evening meditation session, which was like at 7:30. So that's when the day started. So from 7:30 in the evening until about 10:30 the next morning was considered a silent time. So over half the time in the monastery was considered to be a time for silence. We weren't supposed to speak with each other. And we'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it wasn't like, you got up at 9 and who cared? But you got up at 4, so it was like, there were 6 hours there, living your life where you weren't supposed to be speaking. But there was some speech that we did during those 4 hours, and that speech was chanting. We would sit 2 hours of meditation in the morning, and then we'd get up and chant. And it was always very interesting for me to pay attention to my chanting voice and the relationship to my chanting voice and my meditation. And when I felt quite settled on myself, quite at home in myself, I would have a different chanting voice than if I had been really scattered and lost and confused in my meditation. So it was very interesting to watch and see just physically the different quality of my speech as my voice as I went to chanting. And then we go back into silence after this communal chanting. And then in the around 10:30 or so, when I was there, we would break the silence in a sense. And the practice I made for myself was to pay attention of my first speech act, except for the chanting, my first act of speaking to someone in the day, which would have to happen after these 6 hours of silence. And some days I wouldn't notice until I was, late in the afternoon that I've been speaking all day. Speaking all afternoon or something, I didn't. But sometimes I would catch it. And if I really, the point was not so much to catch. Well, the point was just notice the best I could. But sometimes I'd notice before I actually spoke that I intended to speak. And I started to pay attention to the kinds of things that I was saying, the kind of things I wanted to say, and the motivation behind what I wanted to say. And it was a very powerful practice. It was a very wonderful thing to do, to pay attention to the first speech act of each day. Because so much of mine, and I suspect the rest of us also, so much of the ways in which we see ourselves, the ways in which we see the world, gets expressed in our words, in our speech. So I said last week that one of the things we study in right speech is the motivation behind the speech. And the Buddha gave these four list of these four things called wrong speech, and they were speaking of falsehoods, speaking slander, speaking harsh words, words expressed in anger, and speaking idle talk. And so, but the key is to look, what is the intention behind these four kinds of speech, or what's the intention behind any kind of speech? There is, the intention of, we talked about that last week, the intention of lying could be a whole slew of things, embarrassment or ambition or greed or fear, confusion. Could be misplaced kindness to lie. I had a discussion with my wife today about this. Maybe I shouldn't tell you. I'll give you my conversation with my wife. I don't know if that's the right speech. We're going to let it go. I'll ask her if I can talk about it. And And the motivation of slander is sometimes anger, aversion, resentment. Harsh speech, the motivation can be anger, aversion. And the motivation of idle speech. Boredom. How many of you have spoken in a conversation to fill the silence and because you felt insecure in the silence? So idle speech, perhaps. And when I was 19, I was living. We rented our first kind of apartment as college students. We left the dorms and we got our own little apartment for the first time. And in Isla Vista, down Santa Barbara, if some of you know. And it was quite nice, you know. It was a kind of condo or duplex, kind of cross street from the beach. We were serious students. and then we had this balcony in the second floor. We had this balcony with the big glass windows. And once I was sitting outside on the balcony, and the sliding glass doors were closed. And my two roommates were inside the living room having quite a nice, somewhat animated conversation, a warm conversation. But I couldn't hear a word of what they were saying. But I could tell that there was, you know, there's all this, like, there's a lot going on, non-verbally. And I realized at that time, you know, that how much gets expressed in a conversation which is not in the words. That is in the nonverbal expression, in the tone of voice, in the expressions of the hands, or the kind of presence we bring. And so I started to notice then, just little bit at that point, that there's much more in speech than the content, than the meaning of what you're trying to express. So the question is, what is the motivation? What is the expression? What is the motivation that we want to, that is being expressed in our speech acts? And in this slide, you know, is it acts of speech which creates harm, or is it acts of speech which is harmless, which creates the opposite of harm, which creates goodwill or friendship or contact, connection? Is our speech which connects us to people, or is our speech which creates separation, distance? Is it harmful or not harmful? So we talked about the motivations, you know, is the motivation, you know, of wrong speech, and there's the motivations of right speech, of friendship, of loving kindness, of compassion, of caring for someone. The Zen Master Dogen said something like, asking people how they are, how are you, is kind speech. Asking after people's health and well-being is considered kind speech. It's a way of making connection. And we do a lot of that in our culture. You know, some of the ritualistic ways we have of speaking with each other have nothing to do with content. They have to do with connection, right? So we say, you know, how are you? No one's expecting an answer. You know, if you stop them and say, well, let me tell you. You know, the expectation is you say, fine. And it's not a lie because, I mean, technically, I guess it's, but it really what's being established is the connectedness. You're kind of establishing a connection there. And then maybe 5 minutes later, or a couple of minutes later, you can ask, you know, some other quite leading question really gets to how they are. But at first, you establish your connection, the presence.
Oh, I would be going to make the same point. Because I lived in Germany for a while, and there, if you ask someone, how's it going, they'll tell you. Superficial in that way, and I was going to make the point, well, maybe that's not kind speech, because if you're demanding an answer of good, and someone gives you another answer, you're not interested, or you have to go somewhere.
Different rules, different, we have all cultural rules, you know, we have to know the rules of our culture to get along well, and that's one of them, more or less, you know, is, how are you? Fine. How are you really? Well, let me tell you then. And cultural rules that I think I've told you this before. They did about kissing in England. So during the World War II, they noticed there was all this friction between American soldiers and their English girlfriends. And so the psychologists studied it, anthropologists, what was going on. And they found that in both America and in England, there were 12 steps to courting, from the initial hello to I guess, I don't know where it ended, getting married or... But there is, it's 12 steps between, you know, saying hello to sleeping together. And so, however, the steps in between in those 12 were kind of different cultures. So apparently, in America, kissing someone is pretty low on the scale of 1 to 12, you know, the stages of things you do. However, for the English, apparently, it was much higher. It was like, you kissing has to do, like, that's like, you know, 11 before you... So the American soldiers would kiss these English women, and they thought, well, you know, this is pretty casual stuff. And the English women would be very confused. And they would either kind of split, because this was too much, or they would just jump into bed, which sometimes was kind of disturbing for the men, because they didn't understand. You know, how could this happen so fast? So we have to know the rules of our culture. Some of them are unspoken, and only in contrast, or only anthropologists sometimes discover the structure. Anyway, this is a tangent. So right speech, and so what are we establishing? What's the connection? One of the things I think that Buddhists are particularly interested in studying, paying attention to, is motivation in speech, which is self-centered, which is egotistical or selfish, or it comes from a kind of an attempt to hold on to or project or defend some notion, some idea we have of what the self is, of who I am. It's fine to have a self if you really insist on it, but that's different. That's different than the identifications. I like the word the representations. How do we represent ourselves to ourselves in the world? And I love the word to represent ourselves. Here we are, right? I'm fine. Thank you. Now I'm going to present myself to you, how I really want you to see me. That's called the representation. And we do that to ourselves all the time. So it's the representation. And so the kind of speech that's motivated by our idea to present ourselves in a certain way. The embarrassing example that I gave a couple of weeks ago or last week or something was... just coming in, before coming in here to sit, I was talking to someone outside, and I said, I just mentioned, you know, that I'm not preparing these talks. And, you know, it was just information, right, for them, right? I was just telling them because I thought, you know, good information to have. But, you know, but a piece of what was behind that, the motivation, was my representation. Was I wanted to let them know that I hadn't prepared and that don't judge it. You know, that I wasn't responsible. I was covering myself. And that's an example of speech, which the motivation was a kind of representation. The motivation was self-centered. It came from this way in which I wanted to present myself to someone else. So what is? So how do we present ourselves? Well, how does that come about in our speech? What are we really saying to people when we're speaking? Sometimes when I, not always, but occasionally when I'm talking to some people, to friends or anybody, I look at their eyes, and there's kind of this glazed look, kind of like drugged look. And like, I wonder, where are they? And they're just kind of going along, you know, telling what's really important, telling them. And what it looks like to me is that their attention and their involvement and everything is completely tied up in what they're trying to say, that they've lost contact with me and the world around them. Like, it's so important that they're, and it's kind of like a drug state, intoxicated state perhaps. because they've lost touch. And I think that that's not, I don't know if that's right speech, to lose touch. Because if right speech is connectedness, you know, and you've lost touch with the person you're talking to, then, you know, is it right speech? So, Zen Master Ryokan was a poet. He loved words. Words are beautiful. Words are kind of magic. Tremendous power in words. Tremendous in the way they're spoken and what they convey and the effect they have on people and ourselves. And, when all thoughts are exhausted, I slip into the woods and gather a pile of shepherd's purse. Like the little stream making its way through the mossy crevices, I too quietly turn clear and transparent. To turn clear and transparent. But apparently Zen Master Ryokan wasn't always so clear and transparent, because these are the precepts he wrote for himself. And most lay Buddhists are happy with having five precepts. And Zen priests are usually happy to have 10. But he has 3 pages of them. And this is what, this is the precepts he's going to guide his life by. Take care not to talk too much, talk too fast, talk without being asked, talk gratuitously, talk with your hands, talk about worldly affairs, talk back rudely, argue, smile condescendingly at others' words, use elegant expressions, boast, avoid speaking directly, speak with a knowing air, jump from topic to topic. Are you laughing at me? Use fancy words. Speak of past events that cannot be changed. Speak like a pendant. Pendant? Pendant? It's spelled P-E-D-A-N-T. Pedant. Pedant?
Pedant? He's using elegant words.
It's, or the translator. Avoid direct questions, speak ill of others, speak grandly of enlightenment. Carry on while drunk. Speak in an obnoxious manner. Yell at children. Make up fantastic stories. This is a good one, I thought. Speak while angry. Name drop. Ignore the people to whom you are speaking. Speak sanctimoniously of gods and Buddhas. Use sugary speech. Use flattering speech. Speak of things of which you have no knowledge. Monopolize the conversation. Talk about others behind their backs. Speak with conceit. Badmouth others. Chant prayers ostentatiously. Complain about the amount of alms. Give long-winded sermons. Speak effectively, effectively like an artist. Speak effectively like a tea master. So apparently speech was an issue for Zen Master Ryokan. He had his hands filled. Yes?
I'd like to comment on just trying to find a balance, but I think so many times when you ask people in our society, like, people have just used words to bring themselves down, so their concept of themselves is like, oh, I'm not very good, or I start listening, like, people just start talking to me, like, oh, I don't really like my job, and I don't think I'm really good at what I want to do, and then on the other extreme is just sometimes, like, I'm flying really high, and I like what Nelson Mandela says in his inaugural speech, just saying, like, our greatest fear is the light that we have within us. And so learning to be able to radiate that light so we can unconsciously liberate that light in others. And so a lot of times when people ask me how I'm doing these days, I'm feeling really high. It's like, yeah, I'm great. I'm a beautiful human being. And it's to do it in a way that's like, not that I'm egotistical, but if I don't tell myself this stuff, nobody else is. So, and also, I mean, I guess I just feel like I'm so young, so kids need a lot of attention, so it's like, me, 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 look at me. And it's just, but I try to just check in with myself sometimes. It's like, well, am I taking up a lot of airtime right now and not giving the other person a chance to put in that word? So that's something I'm trying to balance out.
So the balance, and it was interesting when you started off, you said, you radiate the light rather than speak about it. And of course, if someone asks, we should speak. And your example is great. You know, speak well. But can we radiate rather than and the balance between speech which is aggrandizing something and speech which is deprecating. And so a lot of people oscillate between the two. You know, we go to eat at a restaurant, and it's like, you know, that was really the greatest restaurant. You know, it was the greatest. And I think sometimes the aggrandizing the restaurant is a statement about ourselves. You know, look how good I am. I went to the greatest restaurant. You know, is it, you know, there are 12,000 restaurants in San Francisco. and then deprecating ourselves. And that's really common in our culture. And what are some of the reasons why we do that, do you think? I mean, one reason it could be true, right? but it's unlikely. I think it's unlikely. When I listen to people and they're really putting themselves down, it's not really true. But so why do we do it?
Doesn't most unskillful speech come from fear?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it does, and hate. But maybe a lot of hate comes from fear too. Yes, Mark.
On a very subtle level, one of the things that I notice is that we're kind of asking questions to ourselves, like, why can't I do this? Why do I always fail this test? And in some way, we're cornering ourselves, because the only answer that our mind can come up with are kind of degrading things. You can't do this because you're not smart enough. It doesn't matter whether the answers are true. We've kind of cornered ourselves with the question that we ask ourselves internally. And that's where looking at intention, we can have the highest and you know, most compassionate intention for ourselves, then we can ask the question, like, how can I improve myself in this? How can I let myself be all that I can be? Mm-hmm. How can I be the most, you know, fulfilled person, you know, within? So to me, that's one level of looking at intention. It's just looking at the way we're kind of asking our questions in life, and maybe we can change those questions to be more supportive.
That's very nice. Very nice.
One thing I noticed when you're reading the list of precepts is how natural it is for me to hear something like that and just think of them as absolute, like, I'm not supposed to do this, I'm not supposed to do this, I'm not supposed to do this. And that's something that I'm usually not conscious of. And I presume some of it's cultural, some of it may be individual, but it's just interesting. I'm wondering if you think it's generally cultural towards the West, just the way the West is from our more pure religious perspective. That looking at absolute.
I don't feel like I make a comparison with any other culture, but there is a very strong the cultures, but there is a very strong tendency in the West for moralistic absolute thinking. You know, and it comes from the biblical tradition, where it's, you know, it's God's will and God is absolute. If we look at Buddhist religion as opposed to Buddhist culture, Buddhism as a spiritual tradition doesn't offer absolutes, or very rarely does. It has a few, but it tends to look more at the situation and try to understand all the different pieces, and what is the wise thing to do in that situation. And the precepts then are the precepts in Buddhism are not these absolutes, but are more like guidelines.
Yeah, the point I was trying to make is just how ingrained our thinking gets, similar to what this person was saying. Just if you're so used to, you know, years of saying the same things to yourself or assuming the same things immediately, the intention of compassion seems very, you can release somebody, have an idea that you never had before, different way of looking at it.
Yeah. Pesha.
Sometimes when someone's self, deprecating and they're talking to me, I realize that they're wanting me to refute them and tell them how wonderful they are. Mm. And I used to fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. Because it generally would be phony on my part. I may not know them, I may not think that they're wonderful. So I try to stop that. But it's like some false humility. No. And I think the reverse of that is also true. Some of us are not comfortable with being complimented. And when we are, we tend to then make light of our abilities. It's not, and it's the reverse of what you were saying.
Right.
I also found myself doing it when I'm in teaching situations and you know, telling tales on myself, if you will, using a degree of self-deprecating humor to bring me down so I seem more fallible, more approachable to the person mm-hmm. that I'm teaching.
So if the compliments are sincere, it's a generous thing to receive them. Oh, thank you. That's very kind. You might not even agree. You might not necessarily agree, but you don't have to rush to. You don't have to disagree with them. It's just an opinion. So, thank you. And I think it's nice. It's nice to. It's a generous act to allow someone to be generous to you. Yeah. System.
Communication. And that can all, I think that should also be considered as part of right speech.
So then part of what can be studied is in your general conversations, if there's a balance between listening and speaking, or the desire to speak and the desire to listen, in general your conversations, where do you fall in that balance? Do you tend to be a person who mostly wants to speak, or are you mostly a person who wants mostly just to listen? And it's interesting to find out, and I suppose that, I don't know, but I never thought of it, but I suppose that the best would be to have a balance in a conversation. You're as willing to speak as you are willing to listen.
This didn't have to do with her wishing to speak. It had to do with her wishing to think her own.
Oh, I see.
So she's making up stories.
I see. She was removed. She wasn't in the conversation even. That's beautiful that you did that. Yes.
In most cultures, it's considered polite to be a little self-deprecating. It's considered to be polite to boast. If you're complimented, that was great, and you say, I know.
Yes.
Could it be almost right communication? Because it seems like our culture is very attached to the speaking part of interacting. And it's clear what one's intention is way more important than the actual words that are said. At work today, I was working with a family that had been shot, and the neurosurgeon was telling the wife that it was really bad news. And we were walking to see the patient, and he held her hand. And I was stunned, because this guy's really, and other interactions, very unpleasant, but he was so nice to this woman. And the touching her said so much more.
So there's many things to be said besides what's said in words. Yes?
When you mentioned that experience of talking to someone and you see that they're kind of glazed over, it really reminded me of the past 10 days I spent in Los Angeles. Example is you're at a checkout stand and you've paid for something, and the person who is working at the cash register sort of talking to someone else and giving you your change, and if you move your hand over, they're not really there. But that happens in so many other ways. And I found myself wondering, you know, I guess we could say, what would be right speech in this situation? Is there a way that I can radiate to this person or connect with them, depending on how much energy I had and resources and whatever. Because the easiest thing is just keep your hand there and get the money and get out. But I've been at other times really felt that sort of the best thing I could do that moment was just move my hand over, have the change drop, and have that person go, oh, I wasn't paying attention. But it's so easy to get into a kind of pride about that. Here I am awake, and I'm going to, you know, zap you.
Yes.
So that it was really this moment of like, what's the best thing to do right now?
A good question, but this is where what comes up to my mind is these four criteria that the Buddha gave for right speech, which could be any kind of right action, I suppose. Is it truthful? Is it kind? Is it necessary? And is it is it conducive? Right? No. Is it truthful? Is it kind? Is it useful? And is it conducive to concord? Does it make for community between people? And so in that situation, it could be that the person just get pissed at you, and they might have gotten a little bit of lesson, but I don't know if it's always kind to be teaching people things. You know, maybe the kind thing would be just simply, they are giving it to you, just take it and wait for another day. You know, maybe another day you'll have a chance to be with them in a more full way, and or their own karma, their own actions will eventually reach them, and so they'll learn it some other way. But I don't know if we have to be the one who always teaches. But maybe, and sometimes it's appropriate. Yeah.
Usually what I do in lines, the checkouts and whatnot, is I make a real point of getting eye contact. And when I put my hand out to either give them change or to receive change, I do it in such a way where usually it almost forces them to touch me.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a physical contact and eye contact, it just seems to be a much more pleasant
affair. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it's not a matter of teaching anything, it's just a matter of making the connection.
So starting off that way sometimes, not waiting to the end to make the connection, but kind of insisting on it at the beginning. There's this, reminds me of this very famous the study they made of, I think it was checkout counter, clerks and checkout counters. And they suddenly had the clerks, maybe the actors or whatever, some of them would touch the customers as they gave the money, and some of them wouldn't touch them, just kind of hand them, the, you know. And then they'd go out outside in the parking lot and they'd survey the customers to see, you know, what they thought of the checkout clerks. And the ones who were subtly touched got a much higher rating for being friendly or something like that. And the only difference was, you know, they were, you know, just very slight physical contact. And the... Yes?
It isn't always easy to see what, you know, is necessarily the right speech or the right action. But one of the things that happens in considering a precept is that it develops a certain mindfulness of, let's say, speech in this case. And in the process of mindfulness of speech, and I suspect that writer's speech evolves.
I think that's very, very well said. That we want to be very careful. I mean, hopefully we're, you know, what we're doing is mindfulness practice, and not rule practice. So it isn't just kind of taking all these as being rules or measuring what our choices against the rule, but rather using a guideline to help us become more mindful, and then from the mindfulness, as you say, choosing wisely. Yeah.
Says it should reflect your own sense of integrity. In other words, if there's a part of you that really feels that something needs to be said, then is it right speech to say it, or is it right speech not to say it, or is it irrelevant?
I think that, well, if you're asking for a kind of Buddhist approach, this is where what Marty said is very important, is to be mindful of the situation and figure out in the situation what seems best and right to you. But then these three guidelines, you know, is it truthful what you're going to say? And is it kind? Is it useful? Was it useful? Will it have an effect? If just to say something and it's not going to have any usefulness, the person's not going to hear it. It might not be, you know, it might be a waste of energy if the person's really not going to hear it.
Yeah.
And so maybe you shouldn't even bother. But I don't know. I don't have a clear... But we have to take care of ourselves, that's for sure. And sometimes it takes being very, very strong, putting down our foot or saying very strong statements about how it is for us so that people can hear, so that we don't continue to get harmed.
Yes.
So the question is, it can be framed, what will alleviate the harm in this situation? So, and for everyone. Yes, definitely. But then if you are going to speak, can you make that speech in such a way that it also not harmful to the person you're speaking to?
Yes.
So rather than just simply stating what it is for you, but being careful with that speech so that you both take care of yourself and say what has to be said, but so that it comes out perhaps in a harmless or a kind way to the other person. But sometimes, you know, as mothers often know, parents, that sometimes in order to get their attention, you have to speak very strongly. And which, you know, sometimes being strong speech is kind speech. Yes?
What I wanted to say in response to this woman was saying is that not only is there something to be said about making sure that what you say is truthful and kind, because it may very well be truthful and kind.
Yeah.
But there's also something about taking responsibility for the reaction that may come back to you, because not everybody wants to hear the truth, and not
right.
everybody will accept your kindness as a kindness.
Right. So I think, to me, it's understanding the system that you're in, the interchange, understanding, getting some sense of what the consequences might be, and then taking, that's part of what we might mindful of in trying to understand how to speak. Peggy.
Just as I listen, so as I've been listening, what's coming up for me is that there's the form of speech that we talk about, like that list. You know, I won't speak this way, or I won't be boastful, or talk too much. And then I remember last week we talked about what drives us underneath, what's happening that we do this. I think somebody talked about it today, which is the vulnerabilities that we feel, and that we're unskillful. We don't know how to express ourselves, or we absorb ways of communicating. When I focus on, especially with other people, but also with myself, which is the same way of the judging, when I focus on the form of the speech, I end up judging either myself or someone else. But if I can somehow listen for the underlying vulnerability and acknowledge that, that's where the community can happen, and that's for myself as well as for the other person. So like even if somebody, I remember a wonderful woman who was my child's nursery school teacher, who she used to say, whenever I see a mother, when she first did it, I thought she was going to say something really terrible to that mother. She said, whenever I see a mother in the shopping mall and she's yelling at her child, you're like, go right up to that mother. And I'm sure she's going to say, I say, stop you yelling at the mother. She's like, I say, wow, it must be so. In the same sense. It's hard sometimes because of my own reaction. To really pay attention to that helps me with my right listening, my right speech.
Beautiful. And then our response can be hopefully or possibly more compassionate than reactive. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful example in the supermarket. I'll have to try that. New idea. Yes?
One of the things you were saying about knowing the system, I find at work, I've been kind of noticing this in the last week, there's just so much that, you know, goes on that seems like idle talk, you know. It's just, I mean, you wouldn't be there if you weren't being paid to be there. I mean, these aren't people that you would call up and ask out to go to a movie or whatever. I mean, and some people where I work just, you know, it's like whatever you say, they have something negative to say, or they're just kind of, you know, always wanting something, or, you know, it can be any different thing, but once in a while, often on Mondays, I'm just like, you know, thinking, what is your problem? Just get over it. And then I find that, you know, it's sometimes it's just, you know, me that has the problem too, you know. But I guess the point of it, I don't know what, but maybe I'm just venting, because it's like, I don't want to be compassionate, I don't want to be conducive to, you know, good spirit and all this stuff. I'm going to get a piece of licorice, every time I go to get a piece of licorice, this woman says, what is she, you know, oh, here you go again, blah, blah, blah.
Buy your licorice on Friday and keep it.
Not mine.
My response to that is, I think the sensitivity to all this idle talk is, I would just say, like, how is this serving me? Like, why is this around me? And then having compassion is just saying, like, maybe their awareness isn't at the same level that I'm at, and so that's all they know what to talk about right now. And it's hard. It's really hard having that acceptance. And for me, I'm just learning not to let those words hurt me. Because just knowing that that's the only way that these people know how to talk to me. And then I'm also just working on sometimes that I tend to jump from topic to topic or talk too fast, and just saying, like, learning to, like, slow down and saying, what am I trying to communicate with this person? What am I trying to share?
It's So I'm very, you know, just starting with Peggy said was about if we can understand what's really behind the source behind what people are saying, we can have a whole different relationship to them and what's going on than if we just take it at the surface level. So I think maybe we should stop. It's late, and if it's too tired, it's hard to speak right. You warmed up? So thank you. Thank you. What?
You have a lot to say about Greg's speech.
Yeah.